Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. It seems as though there were crises within crises this past year. One of them rippled through the Ohio Valley's addiction treatment community. The COVID-19 pandemic was shutting down many public places and businesses. In a region long plagued by the opioid epidemic, health experts feared the sudden isolation would lead to relapses and overdoses. Sadly, recent data confirm those fears, and overdose deaths are on the rise again. In the first of a series of reports, Corinne Boyer explores the addiction crisis during a pandemic.
At the end of last year, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released startling new data on drug overdose deaths. From June 2019 through June 2020, at least 81,000 people had died from drug overdoses, setting a new record for the U.S. West Virginia saw a 32% increase in overdose deaths, and Kentucky deaths climbed by 27%, both higher than the national rate of 21%. In Ohio, deaths rose by 16%. Terrence D. lives in Lexington and is a member of Narcotics Anonymous. He uses a pseudonym when publicly speaking about NA. As a small business owner, Terrence says the pandemic has hurt financially, but the isolation has been the hardest.
We recover in meetings together, our families, we've raised our families together, our kids know one another. We generally go to eat after meetings or coffee or other things. We socialize together, and all that's changed. And it was an abrupt change.
Recovery groups are a crucial component of sobriety for many, but those meetings stopped when shutdown orders forced people to stay home, taking a toll on mental health. Public health resources have been overwhelmed by the pandemic, forcing the addiction crisis to take a back seat. Despite that, people across the region are working on solutions for addiction treatment during coronavirus. Terrence is a member of the North Star Online NA group and helped in-person meetings shift to online meetings.
Everybody was online within a week. And that was because we had spent a little bit of time, you know, with some minimal training.
Sharon Walsh directs the Center on Drug and Alcohol Research at the University of Kentucky. She says it's important to understand how the pandemic affects addiction.
There are a number of things that people have speculated that could have contributed to that initial increase. So people having more despair, being isolated, the risk when someone uses opioids alone of dying is greater than if they're using with somebody else.
Walsh is also the principal investigator of the Healing Community Study at UK. Participating communities in Kentucky, Ohio, Massachusetts, and New York aim to reduce opioid overdose deaths by 40%. When finished, it will be used as a treatment model for other communities. UK public health professor Dana Quisenberry helps to analyze overdose death data for the state. She says that as emergency medical responses for overdoses increased, so did the number of people refusing to go to an emergency department.
It makes sense that some of the issues that have been identified in other jurisdictions about, you know, fear of arrest, fear of COVID, and being taken to the hospital and getting exposed to COVID.
The pandemic has also taken an enormous amount of public health resources, and that impacts addiction treatment services like syringe exchange programs. Sharon Walsh again.
So, you know, they had to deploy all of their effort, staff, money to addressing COVID first, which took the priority away from the opioid crisis.
Online meetings have helped those in recovery stay connected, but Terrence says online meetings aren't for everyone.
The younger population are used to looking at screens. That's not the case for, you know, our members that are 50, 60, 70, 80 years old. And also being the portion of the population that is most vulnerable to catching COVID-19, I think it's been the hardest on them.
Terrence says he's not sure that the public understands what's at stake, as the addiction crisis has worsened during the largest global health crisis in a century. Just one bad decision to use again could kill someone, regardless of how long they've been in recovery. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Corinne Boyer.
This is the first of three stories that look at the addiction crisis during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Ohio Valley Resource is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and WEKU. Our ongoing series on racial justice and equality continues. Our host is Dr. Gerald Smith, professor of history at UK and pastor of the Pilgrim Baptist Church in Lexington. Dr. Smith also co-chairs with Rosalyn Akins the city's Commission for Racial Justice and Equality.
It is my privilege to welcome to today's program Dr. Dwayne Mack, Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at Berea College. Dr. Mack has been with the college since 2003, has taught American history, African American history, and general studies. In addition to his administrative position at Berea College, he also serves as Professor of History and the Carter G. Woodson Chair in African American History. He is the author of Black Spokane, The Civil Rights Struggle in the Inland Northwest, as well as numerous other publications. One of those publications is the book Law Enforcement in the Age of Black Lives Matter, co-edited with Dr. Sandra E. Weisinger. Dr. Mack, how did you become interested in the history of policing?
That's a great question, Dr. Smith. I think it's partly because of my childhood growing up in Brooklyn that partly inspired me to embark on such a research project later in life. I recall the killings of Eleanor Bumpers in 84 when I was a teenager. The year before that, Michael Stewart, who placed a chokehold on Michael Stewart, killing him on a subway platform back in 83. And these stories remain a part of my consciousness. And then you have recent episodes of police malfeasance that triggered me, no pun intended, to take a deeper dive into the history of policing.
You co-authored actually the first chapter in the book with your wife, Dr. Felicia Mack. The first chapter in the book, Law Enforcement in the Age of Black Lives Matter, is titled Policing with Impunity, Racialized Policing in the 21st Century. So tell us a little bit more about that chapter.
We looked at Felicia and I, we looked at how police operate today or have operated historically with impunity. It looks at the dynamics of implicit bias and how it evolves into acts of explicit bias and deadly consequences. It looks at how policing has been racialized since slavery. I was also thinking about why it's important to examine policing through the lens of history. I think policing is connected to our collective historical past, from slave patrols and slave catchers to convict leasing after the Civil War and after slavery ended, to the role it played during a lynching in, say, 1919 in Rosewood, Florida, or the Tulsa, Oklahoma riot, where police officers participated in that riot, to, say, the Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965 with our recently departed John Lewis, Congressman Lewis. It's always played a role in our historical past. It's a part of our collective past as a nation. So we're looking at the history of policing from slavery to the present, to current uprisings and issues with police malfeasance. You know, why do police act with impunity? What is the color of law? Why do police see race first? You know, it's been part, like I said, of our fabric, of our country's history. It's interwoven, it's intertwined with our nation's history. So that's one of the reasons. And living in Appalachia, you know, for the past 17 years and having four children, we realize that, you know, we want to educate ourselves. We do participate in protests. We do support peaceful protests, but we also want to protest rationally and understand the complexity of policing. So this was a tool that not only will help others, but also help us as a family understand the dynamics of policing, especially having two boys and two girls. We wanted to leave something behind us, share some information with them through a historical perspective on the history of policing and why we need to reform the system of policing.
Have you ever had, quote unquote, the talk with your children?
I've had the talk, not only with my boys, but with our girls as well. We have three that are drivers. And there's always anxiety, especially with Black parents, when our children learn to drive. That's one of the things that we dread as African-American parents, that, you know, our kids have that license and they now are free to roam around and drive. But we understand there are some consequences that come with that, and that they are targets, that implicit bias does exist. They could be pulled over. They could be arrested. So we've had to have that talk with our children about what to do. Keep your hands on the steering wheel. Say, yes, sir. No, ma'am. Be very polite. Don't reach for the glove compartment. So we've had that talk multiple times. And this is something that we think about all the time, even with our 21-year-old. It doesn't matter your gender. You can be pulled over and end up like Sandra Bland.
How do your children respond?
They respond like, we know, we understand, because, see, they're socialized in an environment that's majority white. So they haven't had those interactions, the same interactions we had, my wife growing up in North Carolina and me growing up in Brooklyn. Our interactions with law enforcement was a little bit different. So they do say that they understand and they comprehend what we're saying. But, you know, it'll become a reality, God forbid, if anything ever happens and they're pulled over. Hopefully they'll put into practice what we've expressed to them and shared with them about how to navigate and operate and respond to law enforcement.
So with that being said, how can we alleviate racialized policing in America? You know, what's the solution or solutions?
Well, you know, one thing is hiring competent police officers, mental evaluations, making sure they have adequate education instead of just a high school diploma. They should have a 4-year degree with additional training after that. Establishing community review boards where the community has a role and plays a role in not necessarily policing the police, but monitoring police activity and engagement in their communities, making sure that police officers live in the communities that they police so that it's not an enemy combatant type relationship where I'm the enemy and you're coming into my community to contain me. Making sure that technology such as body cams, dash cams operate properly, make sure that police officers are using this technology. It would have been helpful in the case of Breonna Taylor to have a body cam going at that time. Consent decrees are another way to improve policing where the federal government, the Department of Justice, is involved in making sure that police departments are being held accountable. And another thing that should happen, remove military-grade equipment from police departments. Ever since LBJ in the 1960s, you know, one of my areas of interest is the civil rights movement, and this is where the history of policing comes into play. You've had a federal government that has funneled or given state governments and local governments millions and millions and millions of dollars for policing. And along with that, they've given military-grade equipment to police departments. There's no need for grenade launchers and military-grade vehicles, armored vehicles, in Black communities and brown communities. So remove those military-grade equipment or that military-grade equipment from police departments. That would be very helpful.
Do you think there should be separate civilian review boards, or should there just be citizens added to the disciplinary process that is already in place?
It should be citizens or residents of that community who should be on those review boards because they know their community the best. You shouldn't have people from the outside because those are the individuals that have the day-to-day interactions with police officers. So they know best how to, and most African-Americans, as we all know, are law-abiding citizens. And they know what's going on in their communities. And they, too, want to clean up, if it needs cleaning up, their community. So they should be involved in that process.
As a historian, what did you think about the protest in Louisville and the nation, of course, regarding the killing of Breonna Taylor? In other words, what are your thoughts on that, the protest, just that whole tragic event, And especially, you know, if you would comment on the no-knock warrants and defunding the police.
Oh, I definitely, as a historian, as a Black parent, support the Black Lives Matter movement and those efforts of Black, whites, brown, people from all backgrounds, racial backgrounds and ethnicities coming together to challenge the status quo and to protest against police brutality, especially in the case of Breonna Taylor, which that high risk warrant usually leads to death, unfortunately, when it comes to Black people. It's a shoot first mentality. But as far as the protests, you know, I definitely supported them. My wife supports them and our children were involved. We were involved in a local protest in Berea and Richmond. And as you know, as a historian, if it were not for the local protests during the 1960s, you wouldn't have a nationwide protest. So we fully support letting our voices be heard for justice. And as far as the thoughts on no-knock warrants, they should be banned. A high-risk warrant should not be given or executed. In these situations, like I said, it's a shoot-first mentality. As a historian in this book, in this chapter, we looked at Ayanna Stanley, in 2010 and Jose Ortiz in 2011. Both were killed by SWAT teams, you know, SWAT teams that were founded when? In the 1960s, because LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, President Johnson, gave funding through a law enforcement agency that he created to create SWAT teams in places like California and New York. You know, a SWAT team is supposed to go in and negotiate and help during a bank robbery alleviate the situation. But instead, historically, SWAT teams have destroyed Black lives and Black bodies. So Stanley and Ortiz are two prime examples, one Black, one brown. It doesn't matter. It's a shoot first mentality. And as you know, with Breonna Taylor, that was the same thing happened where you had police officers, and I'm not sure if they were SWAT, who just went in and with reckless abandon and shot up an apartment complex, not caring who was in that complex. And the end result is a dead African-American woman. Not only is she African-American woman, but she was a first responder as well.
If you would, just on your closing comments about the Attorney General's decision and this whole issue of defunding the police, if you just kind of close us out with your thoughts about that.
I think we should explore reallocating funds. Instead, like I said, of military tanks and grenade launchers, provide police departments with mental health experts. Every emergency does not need 20 police officers with guns drawn on a naked male in Rochester, New York in 2020. You know, this individual was having a psychotic episode. So, you know, we need more healthcare professionals, mental health care professionals in police departments, less weapons of mass destruction. They serve no purpose on city streets, military tanks. Our soldiers don't even walk around with the warrior complex that some officers display. And my thoughts on the Attorney General's decision, I believe it was wrong. Daniel Cameron should have sought murder charges and not wanton endangerment. It shows that police departments, district attorneys, prosecutors, and even attorney generals are too closely aligned. And they look out for each other. That's why we need not only to revise or look at how policing is done, we also need to look at the carceral state and how to reform that whole prison industrial complex.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Mack. We've been listening to Dr. Dwayne Mack about his book, Law Enforcement in the Age of Black Lives Matter. Again, thank you very much, Dr. Mack, for this very enlightening interview.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, an effort to step up the role of rural libraries in helping families make sure the kids are reading on par by third grade.
Third grade is that pivotal first point where if they're behind at third grade, it unfortunately means they're going to be behind or their likelihood of being behind is greater at high school graduation and even going into college.
A look at a big new solar farm here at EKU.
Essentially, you get 450,000 kilowatt hours of electricity each year, and that's enough to power 40 households.
And a book that nails a struggle common to many Kentuckians thinking about their futures.
We all deal with that struggle of should I stay or should I go? How can I move forward? And I really wanted to reflect that.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
You can take Eastern Standard with you wherever you go with the WEKU mobile app. Easy to find in your app store. Just search for WEKU. You can listen to previous editions of Eastern Standard online at eswku.org. Navigate to our archive tab and take a deep dive into our programs. Curious about something? Have a topic to suggest for our consideration? You can email your idea to es@eku.edu. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Children who are in the third grade today, that's 8 and 9 year olds, will, before we know it, be voting and making public policy. And it's at this stage in a child's development when the ability to read is at a critical moment. But there's a problem.
We just have too many young people not reading at grade level by third grade.
And that's a big problem because
third grade is that pivotal first point where if they're behind at third grade, it unfortunately means they're going to be behind or their likelihood of being behind is greater at high school graduation and even going into college.
Dreema Gentry, Executive Director of Partners for Education at Berea College. Working under a grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services, Berea is partnering with Save the Children to create the model for a national network to pull together rural libraries and community stakeholders, all with the aim of improving third grade reading.
Well, what we've realized is that what works here in Appalachian, Kentucky will work other places. And when we're working on the ground in Eastern Kentucky, we've always connected and partnered with libraries because we know that our rural libraries are the heart of a community. And they do bring together stakeholders and parents and young people. And so we saw the power of those libraries. It led us to think that if it works here, we could actually accelerate growth by working in other rural places and creating opportunities for librarians in other rural places to also work on third grade reading and then also to connect with each other. And that's what really brought us to this idea of a network.
When Dreema approached us with this idea and opportunity for collaboration, we jumped all over it.
Leslie Graham, Director of Community Impact for Save the Children U.S. based in Lexington.
We know that students with low literacy achievement struggle year after year academically. They tend to have more behavioral and social problems and have more negative long-term consequences like higher rates of dropping out of high school, juvenile crime, reduced earning potential in their adult years of life.
So what the research will tell us is their chance of graduating high school is less.
Dreema Gentry.
And we know by looking at data on high school dropouts that their chance of entering into the justice system is greater. And their chance of really getting a college degree is much, much less, right? And we know that college graduates and those that graduate from some type of post-secondary, their outcomes as far as life expectancy, health, and of course, economic mobility are much greater. So by not being reading at grade level by third grade, it's really putting a lot of barriers in the place of that lifetime success that we want for all young people.
Well, we know that the Ballard-Carlisle County Public Library, for example, gets nearly all of its budget from state aid. The Hickman County Library relies on state aid for 57% of its budget. It's 23% for Knott County, 22% in Livingston County. Has state budget cutting in recent years had a particular impact on rural libraries?
They have, and not just in Kentucky, but across the country. We find that rural libraries as a whole are under-resourced, and some of that is because of the state budgets in states, but also that so much of library funding across the nation also depends upon the tax base locally. And so especially in those rural regions where there have been economic crises, the funding for libraries has been less. And so one of our goals with this network is to engage philanthropy and private funders and corporate funders that may have an interest in funding a rural library, but they don't have that connection to the rural library. So we're hoping that this network can be an opportunity that the participating libraries can find out about opportunities, but also potential funders can make connections to small libraries around the country.
What about digital natives? Today's 8- and 9-year-olds are members of a generation growing up immersed in digital media and technologies. Save the Children's Leslie Graham.
Technology has definitely a role in children's education, but we also find the role of, you know, holding books, tangible books, sitting in front of a book, really immersing yourself in it. There's so much value to that. And so we want to foster that love of learning, love of reading in youth across the country. I think libraries really hold a unique role. Most of us have fond memories of going to the public library with our families. And so I think it's a balance. It's a balance of reading books digitally. It's a balance of reading books, you know, holding books in your hand. We also know that a lot of our families lack access to books. And so one of the things that we want to make sure is that we're prioritizing building home libraries, getting books into the hands of children. Also, whether, you know, digital or print, but definitely see the value in building home libraries and making sure children across the country have access to literacy-rich environments.
Collaboration is at the heart of this effort to make a big difference in the futures of rural third graders.
We know schools can't do it alone. One organization can't do it alone. Libraries can't do it alone. But if we all come together and with this more collective impact approach, with local leaders and champions, we can make even more of an impact and ensure that children reach their full potential and don't fall further behind.
Again, Dreema Gentry.
It takes many different strategies to improve third grade reading. And it starts first and foremost with the schools. So schools during the in-school time need to really be working on improving third grade reading. The schools can't do it alone. There needs to be that what we call wraparound. So libraries and other community groups need to also be contributing to supporting third grade reading through summer reading programs, parenting classes, engaging volunteers and mentors to work and to read to young people. And that also we have to realize that the third grade reading piece also is influenced by health conditions and housing conditions and food stability. Because if a young child is hungry, they're not going to be ready and be able to read at grade level. And so it really is working in communities to develop strategies to ensure that families are supported, young people are supported, so that you have that right, I guess, that right foundation for learning.
A fellowship program is being established at 22 libraries across the country to help them pull together resources in their communities.
If they reach out and engage with the local school districts, the health department, the food banks, the housing providers, they bring all of those folks together and also include your county government and your local government and your mayor's office. If they can bring together a whole group into the room and say, okay, we want to create a community and a place where every young person's reading at grade level by the end of third grade, how can we all contribute to this and what can we all do? And it's amazing when you're in rooms like that and you see folks having that discussion because the synergies start happening.
And as Dreema Gentry notes, you don't necessarily have to be in the room to make a difference.
Small investments of $1,000 or $5,000 at a local library goes a long way. because those librarians and those who run those libraries have gotten really good at doing work with very little funding, unfortunately.
How can we learn more? Save the Children's Leslie Graham.
We're also in the process of creating a unique website specifically for our rural library partners, and you can find that at www.berea.edu/PFE/rural library.
Leslie Graham of Save the Children U.S., based in Lexington, and from Berea College, Dreema Gentry, Executive Director of Partners for Education. We don't have to go very far to see clear evidence that renewable sources of energy are succeeding fossil fuels. Eastern Kentucky University is now the site of a solar farm that, in terms of its size, is the first of its kind at a public university in Kentucky. And here to tell us about it is Judy Jenkins, Associate Professor of Chemistry at EKU. Dr. Jenkins, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
And we'll get to the size and the power of this new solar farm in just a moment. But first, if you would give us some background on how this came about.
Sure. We have been working on adding solar panels in various places on campus for several years now. I think people sometimes think when a new technology comes along, one day you don't have it and the next day everything has it. And that's just not accurate. So we started with some small arrays for 7 panels and then a 25-panel array. And then with the new science building, we got to put about 150 additional panels up on top of that. And so those were sort of our baby steps, our beginnings in having solar electricity on campus. The solar farm project, we started thinking about probably in 2016, 2017, there's an EKU alumnus, his name is Gary Booth, who really challenged us to think bigger than 100 panels, to think bigger than the steps we had taken so far, and proposed this sort of idea where Eastern would lease the solar panels from a small business and then get to use the power that those panels generated. And so we had the university community on board with that, but we needed a new construction site. So when Kit Carson Commons started coming to fruition, we were able to sort of maximize the efficiency of that construction and also wire in this new solar farm.
And as I understand it, the university put out an RFP, and Starshine Energy, which is Gary Booth's company, won that contract, correct?
That is correct, yeah, because we wanted to make this as affordable and economically wise as we could, and so doing the request for proposal and having a competitive bidding process was helpful in that.
Okay, and I mentioned the size. How big is it?
So it takes up just over an acre of land. It's about 1,200 solar panels. And in terms of energy, it's what we call a 350-kilowatt array. Essentially, you get 450,000 kilowatt hours of electricity each year, and that's enough to power 40 households. So your average home, you could power 40 of them using the amount of energy that these solar panels generate.
And how does artificial intelligence play a role in this?
Right. So one of the things, it's hard to see the future, right? It's hard to know what the weather is exactly going to be like in one day or 10 days or a month out in advance. And if you are a power utility, your customers want electricity continually, regardless of what the weather is. And so we need better ways to anticipate how much energy we'll get out of our solar farm as a function of the weather. So if we're predicting 30% cloudy or whatever that is for the next day, what does that mean in terms of the energy we'll get out of the solar farm? Because then that allows your power plants to supplement the solar panels with other sources of energy on the cloudy days and let the solar panels take over on the sunny days so that we, the customers, have electricity all the time. But that predicting out in the future, we hope to use the data we're collecting with the solar farm to essentially inform artificial intelligence algorithms that would get better and better at predicting the amount of energy we would get out based on a given weather situation.
Well, what is the environmental benefit? By how much will this reduce the university's emissions of carbon dioxide?
Yes, that's, to me, that's the most exciting part of the whole thing. This farm will offset about 320 metric tons of carbon dioxide emissions each year. And so that's about 1% of our total carbon dioxide emission from electricity. And so, you know, with 1,200 panels to be able to offset 320 metric tons of carbon dioxide, like that's big. That's exciting.
And 1% may not sound like much to a lot of people, but is it significant?
It is. We're a huge campus. You know, we've got a lot of buildings that were built in a bunch of different time periods with a bunch of different energy efficiencies. And, you know, we can't just tear down all the buildings and build more efficient buildings. We're like, that's not an economically viable situation. And so some of the other steps that we could do to reduce our emissions are things like the solar farm. And so to be able to impact a campus whose major electricity uses are infrastructure without really changing the infrastructure is a big deal.
Will this solar farm kind of double as a lab? Will it provide opportunities for teaching and learning and even growing future solar entrepreneurs for Eastern Kentucky?
Yes, we see this as a way for students to get hands-on experience, both seeing the technology in action, so being able to walk out to the farm, look at it, see what's going on, be able to get the energy output on a minute-by-minute basis. We can even go down to the panel-by-panel level to see how the farm is working. Students will have access to the data long-term so that they can compare, as we were saying before, compare the what the weather actually was with the energy that was put out and then look at how the algorithms incorporate that data and continue to get better and better at predicting. And then we also, in my research lab, we do research with other types of solar panels, other types of renewable energy and energy storage. And we hope longer term to be able to take developing technologies, things that are still in people's research labs right now, and perhaps try them out on the solar farm. So swap out one of the panels that's currently there for a panel made from a newer type of material that may be more efficient, hook up batteries to the farm. And all along the way, the students get to do that with us and get the hands-on practical skills that they need to take this with them wherever they go, back to their own communities, to take what they've learned and implement it in other places.
There will be energy cost savings on this, and I'm wondering, are those monies earmarked? Is there a way that savings will be specifically applied?
So the savings from our smaller arrays, the 25-panel array and the 150-panel arrays, that money, those panels were donated to us. And so we don't have to recoup the cost of building it. They were given to us. And so those funds go to scholarships for students. We're able to give out about $3,000 a year in scholarships for students based on the savings from those smaller arrays.
Do you anticipate expanding the size and the output of the solar farm that exists now?
I hope so. This is, for us, a proof of concept. It's a much bigger array than we've had on campus before. And so we want to make sure that all the nuts and bolts work out the way we anticipate them working, you know, with maintenance and things like that. And so If this continues to proceed as it has, I think we will build on it. We will grow on that. It's an interesting way for the university to partner with local businesses because it benefits our local businesses as well. This has gone well so far, and I think we will continue to build on that success.
Just briefly, if you could you elaborate on that, how it does benefit local businesses?
Sure. So with the solar farm, Eastern didn't go out and buy the solar panels themselves. This would have been too big of an economic investment for a university to make right now. And so instead, we went to, the RFP process, requesting information from local businesses, essentially giving those businesses a chance to lease that hardware to us. And so, EKU pays the small business that's running the farm a lease fee that is sort of comparable to what we would spend on the same amount of electricity. But then that small business gets the lease payments and takes care of the maintenance for us. So EKU doesn't have to, if something goes wrong, it's sort of like renting a house. If something goes wrong, the small business comes and takes care of it. So from our perspective, that's great. We don't have to worry about the maintenance side of things, but it allows the business to have a customer as well.
All right. Really interesting. Judy Jenkins, Associate Professor of Chemistry at EKU. Thank you so much, Dr. Jenkins.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Darling, you got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go?
Well, that's a question many a Kentuckian has wrestled with. And essayist and author Leah Hampton captures it and runs with it in her book, F-Face, abbreviated here for Family Radio. Leah Hampton, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Leah, one reviewer that I've read describes your book as, here's the quote, a simultaneously raucous and sobering look at rural existence in the modern-day American South. That can be a pretty radioactive subject in our listening area, Eastern Kentucky. It matters here that anybody who writes about life in the region today knows that life firsthand. So tell us about your background.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's really important. So my background is a little unusual. I'm definitely from the region. My father was born and raised in Harlan County, Kentucky. I live, though, in the Asheville area in western North Carolina, and kind of grew up all over the place. My father was in the military, and my mother is British. So I have dual citizenship, and I kind of bounced back and forth between being a mountain girl and being a tea-sipping English girl.
So you've noticed that for you, the Appalachia of the here and now is this place where love and hurt, humor and loss exist in very close mm-hmm. proximity of one another just about all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Did that perception of life in the region serve as a guideline for the stories that you chose to tell in this book?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think what I'm trying to do is, you know, the book, a lot of it is about the symbiotic relationship that we have here in this region with the land and with the mountains and the landscape around us, you know, that's a very intimate relationship. And like all intimate relationships, it's not always healthy, you know, and so there's beauty in it and there's humor in it, but it's also sometimes a hard life and a challenging life. And so I wanted very much to represent the complexity, and also because I think we often oversimplify Appalachian experiences or think of it as a simple life, but it's really complex. And so I wanted to reflect that.
This is a collection of short stories. Were they written over time and collected?
Yes. So this, I would say probably about 5 years total it took me to write all the stories in the collection, and you know, they had different purposes initially, and they just kind of came together, and so they're similar in that they're about the same region, and they deal with ecological issues and a lot of especially feminine experiences, but they're not linked together by any, you know, specific plot or person. So it's like 12 different little slices of the region.
Would it be right of me to say that it seems as though a thread running through these stories has to do with the relationship between the person and environment, between body and land?
Yes, very much. Yeah, that's great. That's a great way to put it. It's definitely about how we act upon the land and the land acts upon us, and that is very often in the body, you know. So there's people in this book who are sick because of something that's happened on their land. There's people who are bettered by getting back to nature. And then there's obviously landscapes that are abused and extracted from and polluted, which is obviously a big problem in Eastern Kentucky, especially. But then also spaces where the land is where it's a symbiotic and more loving relationship with the people on it.
Many of your stories seem to revolve around women who are struggling with their own identity and how who they know themselves to be fits in with their circumstances, work, family, place. Is that a fair observation?
Yeah, that's so true. I really wanted to write about women, and specifically about rural women, because I don't think that as a country, or even as a region, I don't think we think enough about how complex those lives are and how modern our thinking is in a lot of the ways that we try to live as women in Appalachia. You know, there's a lot of books about, you know, what it was like to be grandma in 1930, but there's not a lot of books about what it's like to need reproductive health care in, you know, 2010 in Eastern Tennessee. So those were the kinds of women I was really interested in. And so I was trying to have these women have really modern conversations with themselves in a very old place.
And these are real characters. Are they shaped from people that you know or know of?
Well, yes and no. They're definitely all fictional, and there's only one or two people in the book that are really based on a specific person. So they're not like, it's not semi-biographical or semi-autobiographical as a book at all. However, I did a lot of research. I had a lot of conversations with, you know, firefighters and people who work at the local schools. And I did a lot of field work so that I could kind of build these fictional people. So I think people have told me that they feel like the book is full of their neighbors, but they're not actually anybody's literal real-life neighbors.
Well, many of them seem ill at ease with their existence, sort of like Peggy Lee's song, Is That All There is running on a loop in their heads.
Mm-hmm.
Are you conveying a certain tension between feeling disconnected and longing for something else in a place that where you're supposed to be comfortable?
Yeah, well, that's a heavy question. Tom, is that, or can I have a therapy session now with you? Because I think that's a big question in the book is, you know, where's the hope and where's the open door? But I think people from the region, especially my family and friends in Eastern Kentucky, I think they'll recognize that, because isn't that part of the experience of being here is loving where you are, but also recognizing that living in a space like Appalachia that's been so economically and culturally kind of erased for so long, especially the really diverse communities within Appalachia, it makes it hard. There are limitations. And so we all deal with that struggle of, should I stay or should I go? You know, how can I move forward? And I really wanted to reflect that. So in a lot of ways, it can be a dark book because I try to be really honest about that struggle.
I read the interview with you by Michelle Hogmeyer in Bomb magazine, and you say that for too long the mountains have been at the mercy of patriarchal systems that hurt everyone, including men, and that you set out to feminize the landscape, to regender or maybe even degender Appalachia in the reader's mind. Tell us about that approach.
Well, you know, I just think that we have such a narrow view. Internally, we think of ourselves sometimes as being too old-fashioned and heteronormative in the way that we view the community. We think our communities are whiter and more conservative than they often really are. And externally, we're seen as being this monolith, you know, of red states, when really there's so much progressive politics that originated in Appalachia that's affected our nation's history for the last 100 years. And there's so many powerful communities of color here. You know, I live only 5 miles from Cherokee tribal lands, and that's a huge economic force in my region. So I really just wanted to think about it as a curvy place. These are curvy hills. These are rolling hills with all kinds, teeming with all kinds of life. And I think if we celebrate that, not only do we give it more exposure and really appreciate the women who are here and the diversity ecologically, culturally that's here, but I think also that makes it easier for the men here, because so many of the men I know, even in my own family, are so tender and so complicated and don't ascribe to these kind of, you know, rootin' tootin' shootin' kind of male stereotypes. There's all kinds of men. And so I just wanted to have us change our thinking, because a lot of books about the area tend to be, you know, about drug problems and murders and that kind of stuff. And so I was looking for the reader to look at the other 75% of who's here.
Well, some pretty major economic forces are sweeping over the Appalachian region right now. It's transitioning from coal mining and culture to something else. And tourism gets a lot of mention these days as maybe the next big thing. And this notion is kind of embedded in your stories. Is this an effort to provoke readers to think about the nature of what they may be hitching their wagon to next time?
Very much so. Thank you for noticing that. Yeah, I do. You know, we always have this conversation in Appalachia about we're very gatekeepy. Mm-hmm. Who's from here? You know, who are you kin to? Who belongs here and who doesn't? That's always kind of been true, just culturally for us, that we're suspicious of outsiders and that kind of thing. But then there's also, I live in Asheville, which has a huge tourist industry, and that can be just as extractive and exploitative as, you know, the coal industry and other chemical plants, that kind of thing, that have been in the region. They can do as much damage. And when people come in, I think we want to be welcoming, and we want to make sure that we're allowing our communities to grow and evolve like the rest of the country. But at the same time, there has to be a very careful balance, because it can also be dangerous. And I don't know that it will be the way that we lift ourselves up, you know, certainly not economically. So I think there's some responsibility and some deep thinking that we need to do.
Well, I recommend everybody pick up a copy of F.A.C.E. and give it a read, and I certainly have really enjoyed it. Leah Hampton is author of F.A.C.E. Thanks for joining us, Leah.
Thank you so much for having us.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can hear editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Would you like to suggest an interview for us to consider? Email the idea to us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.